Okay, I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:37 p.m. on Wednesday, April 30th, 2025. Present today, we've got Representative Hannon, Representative Bynum, Co-Chair Shiragi, Co-Chair Josephson, Representative Jimmy, Representative Galvin, Representative Stapp, myself, Co-Chair Foster, and just a reminder, Representative Tomaszewski also. Just a reminder, folks can mute their cell phones. We do have two bills before us today. However, we're just going to take up the first part of the first bill. We do have floor session at 2, so that gives us about 23 minutes or so. The two bills that we have before us are House Bill 78, which is the PERS bill. We're going to introduce the committee substitutes, and then we'll set an amendment deadline. And then the other bill we have is House Bill 91. That's the marijuana tax bill. We're going to have an introductory hearing, take invited testimony, review the fiscal notes, and then set that bill aside. This is all, of course, dependent on how long we go on the floor. And so, again, we will recess at just before 2 o'clock and go to the floor and then hopefully come back later today. So with that, again, our first bill is House Bill 78. We do have a committee substitute. It sounds like there's only one change in the bill. And so if we could just put that on the table and then we can discuss the changes, I would entertain a motion to have as our working draft this new CS. Representative Shiragi.
Co-Chair Foster, I move that the House Finance Committee adopt committee substitute for House Bill 78, Work Draft 34-LS0493/N, Wayne, dated 4/28/25, is our working document.
Okay, and I'll object for purposes of the explanation. With that, I would like to call up my staff, Mr. Brody Anderson, as well as Representative Chuck Kopp, who can both explain changes and answer any questions regarding those changes. So if you could put yourselves on the record and go ahead and get us started.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. For the record, Brody Anderson, staff to Representative Neil Foster.
And Mr. Chairman, thank you. Chuck Kopp, Representative for House District 10.
I'll be starting off explaining the explanation of changes before the committee today. Before the committee today, you have the version N as in November in front of you as your work draft. There are two changes in the bill doing the same thing in two separate locations. Section 23, that it can be found on page 14, starting at line 16 and going through line 20. And then section 76, which begins on page 42, lines 27 through 31. Both of these are listed as subsection G in two different locations. What this new section subsection does is it reduces the post-retirement pension adjustments, or known as PERPA, to 50% for residents. For non-residents that are ineligible for the PFD as qualifications, the qualifications for the PERPA. In effect, this incentivizes retirees to stay in the state. The reason why it's found in two separate locations is you have the PERS program, which is Section 23, and then Section 76 is the TERS portion of it. The reason why this change has happened in the CS is because what this now does is the current CS work draft will now align with what is actually in the actuarial that was presented yesterday. If you go through the detailed Gallagher explanation, there is an explanation that the assumption was the PERPA at 50% was already there. So this only aligns the bill now with the expectation that the actuarial was written to. In previous versions of this bill from previous legislation, that 50% had been existed. So the last time that Gallagher had reviewed it, this was assumed that it was already in the bill this year, and that's why this change has happened. Mr. Chairman, that summarizes the changes.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Representative Kopp, do you have any questions? I think the overall, I guess, one of the main points of this change is that it will actually reduce the funding needed in years going forward. Is that correct, Representative Kopp?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. It reduced the cost of the bill over FY 27 through 39 by about $70-plus million.
Okay, thank you. And so, again, this was just a motion to have before us a new CS. I also would like to recognize that we have with us Representative Allard. And so it was to adopt the new CS, so it would have this new working draft before us. So I'm going to go ahead and remove my objection.
Object.
We've got an objection, Representative Stapp.
Yeah, I think, Coacher Foster, I don't know if I'm reading the CS wrong, but I see a lot more changes than that, Mr. Anderson, like a lot. So on page 9, for example, so there's an entirely new second subsection 2 added. There's an amount calculated by applying a rate established by the board to the base salaries. It doesn't seem like this change is like super material, but it's an or as opposed to where it was before. On page 14 of the bill, we've changed people who can receive benefits in the plan from 8 years to 5 years, and that's line 15. That's not in the summary of changes. So I'm just curious what those do.
Mr. Anderson?
Hey, Mr. Chairman, may I have an at ease?
Brief at ease. Okay, House Finance back on record. Mr. Anderson, would you like to clarify?
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. For the record, once again, Brody Anderson, staff to Representative Neil Foster. Through the chair, Representative, the only changes that were made in this version were those outlined by the explanation of changes and then some remuneration afterwards. Very small few details that can. I do have, it's a large bill, but I do have a red line version that we could submit as documents later on to show that the true only changes were those couple changes in the bill.
Right, I'll remove my objection.
Representative Stapp, okay. So again, Representative Bynum.
Thank you. Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I'm objecting because I don't agree with the change in from the version A to version N. I'm not in support of this provision. and I'll hold my objection for that purpose.
Okay. Would anyone else like to speak to the adoption of the CS? Okay. Hearing none, we have a objection to the motion, and so this would be to adopt version N. And Madam Clerk, if you could please call the roll.
Representative Tomaszewski.
No.
Representative Stapp.
Yes.
Representative Bynum.
No.
Representative Galvin.
Pass.
Representative Jimmy.
Pass.
Representative Allard.
Yes.
Representative Hannon.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Galvin.
Yes.
Representative Jimmy.
Yes.
Representative Josephson.
Yes.
Representative Schrage.
Yes.
Representative Foster.
Yes.
8 yea, 3 nay.
And so on a vote of 8 yea to 3 nays, we have adopted as our committee substitute House Bill 78, Work Draft 34-LS0493/N, Wayne, dated 4/28/25, and this is our working document. So now that we have this new version before us with this this one change, just wanted to open it up to questions. We do have to be on the floor, probably adjourn or recess in about 10 minutes, but I just want to check in with folks, see if you've got any questions. Representative Hannon, and then Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Do you know the fiscal notes that we have they been written to the updated version of N, or are they to the original?
Mr. Anderson?
Through the chair, Representative, the fiscal notes provided were written based off of the actuarial that was submitted by Gallagher, so they should be reflective of the actual, the assumption that it was at 50%.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Bynum?
I just wanted some clarity. I guess maybe we should ask this before. We just adopted a version that's basically saying in order for you to maintain this portion of your retirement that you must qualify for the PFD. And so I'm just wanting to know, does qualification for the PFD, is that required to have state employment or employment under our retirement system?
Representative Kopp?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, this this provision, and if I may back up just a little bit, there were two versions of the bill we were wrestling with. I can appreciate the fact that this is not an employee-friendly version, as you pointed out, so I empathize. But we were wrestling with the numbers of employees, which are about 40% of state retirees that do move out to warmer climates after a career in Alaska. Should they get the same inflation proofing, which is what PERPA is, as somebody who stays in state? And in that discussion back and forth with the actuary, the bill that had removed the penalty of a 50% reduction was introduced, and Mr. Kirshner evaluated the one that assumed it was. And so, as Mr. Anderson has just clarified, the fiscal notes are now accurately reflecting of this version of the bill. The permanent fund eligibility standard is the standard that is used if you're a state resident or not. It's just to tie it to a standard in the law to say, are you a resident? In other words, if you're eligible to receive a dividend, then you would be eligible for the full post-retirement pension adjustment.
Just as a quick follow-up, just I guess a comment, is Alaska currently has lots of opportunity to be resident without meeting the PFD standard. You know, we have people to give a lifelong service to the state, and what we're telling them now is that you have to be able to maintain a PFD standard in order to receive this adjustment in your retirement. Doesn't take into consideration opportunities to travel, doesn't take into consideration medical need or any of that. And so we have residents of the state now that don't qualify for the PFD. They spend a lot of time here in this state. And people that are retired that meet that or that are in the same category. So, again, it's disappointing that we're going to, for the lack of a better word, discriminate against people that have given their life working for this state, and we're going to diminish their retirement because they're not going to be able to qualify for a PFD if they travel too long or they need to go south for medical too long. So, to me, it's a problem, and that's why I objected to the committee substitute, and that's why I'll probably be trying to see if we can make a fixed to this during the amendment process. Thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chair, to speak about it.
Thank you. I've got Representative Hannon and Josephson. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Representative Kopp, is the COLA adjustment different than the PERPA adjustment?
Through the chair, yes, Representative Hannon. This bill does not have a cost of living adjustment, which is tied to housing, energy, and transportation costs, recognized to be much higher in Alaska. The old defined benefit tiers did, which became active once you turned 65. That was a 10% increase on your base pension. That is not present in this bill because of the cost. And again, the post-retirement pension adjustment is simply inflation-proofing dollars, so they don't lose value over time. And again, this CS reflects about a $70 million savings over a 13-year FY27 through FY39 by allowing a 50% reduction of that inflation proofing if someone no longer meets residency requirements. And to Representative Bynum's point, there may be another residency standard we could point to. There are several. The permanent fund eligibility standard does allow for medical travel and does allow for various things that permit people to still get their dividend. But very open to looking at that.
Okay. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. And let me just reprise a statement that another member made so that it's on the record in a different way. Nothing in this bill or the provisions in this work draft change diminish the earned benefit that a defined benefit member would be receiving, meaning they're not – their monthly paycheck – their monthly retirement check does not go down. They just wouldn't get the inflation adjustments that remaining a full-time resident of Alaska would earn them.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Hannon. So well said. If the ARM board determined that inflation proofing in 1 year was 100 basis points, which is 1%, or if it was 25 basis points, which is 0.25, whatever they decided it was, that person who moved out of state would just get half of the improvement. So, but it wouldn't diminish their base retirement. You're absolutely correct.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. I've got Representative Josephson, Allard, and staff. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Representative Kopp, this has already sort of been highlighted, but my mother, for example, was a TERS and a PERS retiree. She, after being here for 50 years, moved to New Hampshire and suffered the loss of the 10% COLA. In that respect, this is in alignment with that policy, right? That is to say, look, there's some reduction if you're not an Alaskan, or at least in this case not a PFD recipient, which is essentially similar. This is a novel concept. It's what we did with COLA.
Yes, Chair Josephson, you are correct. A COLA, though, is in the hundreds of millions of dollars of cost because it's 10% of your entire base salary, whereas a PERPA adjustment can be as little as $15 to $25 a month is what a pensioner would see on their adjustment, on like every July 1. So, but you're right. Philosophically, they are exactly the same principle.
Thank you.
So we need to get down to the floor, so I'm going to go ahead and recess us out here in a moment, but I just want to note that we'll come back to the queue. I do have Representative Allard and Stapp in line. Also, yesterday I mentioned that we would be announcing an amendment deadline, and we'll be setting that for next week, May 5th at noon. So if you have any amendments, if you could submit those to Mr. Brody Anderson or Helen Phillips. I don't know that was a motion, Representative Stapp. You're objecting?
Yeah.
Would you like to speak to your objection?
Mr. Chair, the bill is relatively complex, and Monday at noon is not that much time to really consider. Maybe I could ask for at least Tuesday.
Let's see here. So we're thinking Monday at noon. I'm fine with that. Tuesday at noon, is that fine?
5 p.m. 5 p.m. I think I know that the sponsors, all the sponsors of all the bills are probably more wanting. I think we got the head nod. We're okay. Tuesday at 5 sounds fine with me. Let me check with my staff. I just want to make sure I'm not thinking of anything that I should be thinking about. Okay, so with that, Tuesday at 5, and we're going to recess, and we'll be at the call of the chair for when we come back after floor. Thank you. We'll be recessed at 1:57 p.m. Okay, House Finance is reconvened at 4:28 p.m., and where we left off is we were had introduced and adopted the CS, the new committee substitute for House Bill 78. That's the PERS bill, and I had set the amendment deadline, and we were also going through questions, just checking to see if we've got any additional questions for Representative Kopp or his staff, or anyone who might be online. Looks like we actually don't have anyone online, but with the rollout of the new committee substitute, just wanted to see if anybody had any questions on that specifically, or even the bill, if there were any questions. Do we have any questions, Representative Stout?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Foster. I just have a question on fiscal notes. I know we went over them. They've changed with the actuarial. So just on FY26 and 7, just projected cost of this, looking at it, looks, I mean, a little confusing. I think it's $51 million in FY27. And some of these fiscal notes have startups amounts in FY26 and some don't. So maybe just a quick clarification on that.
Representative Kopp? And you said the fiscal note, which OMB component number of the fiscal note were you referring to?
Yeah, well, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Yeah, there's two that actually have zero OMB components, and I know one replaces the other. So the one that I think is the latest one, even though it doesn't have an OMB component on it, says $40.6 million in FY27 and no appropriation in FY26, but the one it replaced had a $17.4 million appropriation in FY26. So I'm just curious what that material difference is.
Okay, and Representative Kopp.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, so I do not have those fiscal notes in front of me. I would rely on OMB. to speak to them. I stand corrected. I have them in front of me now.
Okay.
Mr. Stapp, your question is to fiscal note. What's the control code in the bottom right-hand corner of the one you're looking at?
Oh, yeah.
V-A-V-C-K, Z-K.
Yeah, I have two, V-A-I-N, Bravo, and V-A-Z-V-K, Z-K, correct.
Right. So this would have been, this was a House Finance Committee produced note. Yes, because this identifies that Galler Buck is in the process of their analysis, which is now complete. So this was a House Finance Committee estimate before we just received the valuation report by Gallagher. My guess is that this one would now be one of the notes that is essentially no longer valid. I would defer to Mr. Anderson, but I think I'm right. I think this is one would be a dismissed fiscal note. Okay. And the two that we would be referring to would be the ones that we now have produced post-Gallagher analysis.
Mr. Brody Anderson, if you can come up, put yourself on the record. Do you need the question repeated? Okay. Mr. Anderson?
To the chair, thank you. For the record, Brody Anderson, staff to Representative Neil Foster. To answer the question in regards to the fiscal notes created by House Finance Committee, those would be considered dead or killed once we got the fiscal notes from the Department of Revenue. So the two that were created by House Finance were in response to the state as the employer and then the state as additional contributions. Those two now have been updated with, I believe I have the proper component being OMB component number 64, control code number GUOES. That one still remains as a fiscal note for the entire thing. That is the cost of running the new program. And then also the other one is from department.
This is the personnel cost, and these two are both pending Buck's analysis. Is it?
Right.
I believe it should be V-A-I-N-B.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have that one in front of me, but they are the new, most recent DOA fiscal notes from Department of Revenue. Those would be the newest one. I know that the final thank you. So, yes, V-A-I-N-B, created by Department of Administration on 415. That one replaces PERS as, this is state as the employer and also as this contribution. So we had two fiscal notes. Department of Administration rolled those two fiscal notes into one, and that's why.
Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Just curious why there's no, on this new fiscal note, V-A-I-N-B, why there's no appropriation for FY26 at all listed.
I believe,
Mr. Edison?
I'll ask Department of Revenue. I believe that is because the actual program would be stood up in FY26, so that's why the previous fiscal note from Department of Administration has the stand-up costs, and then the actual PERS will go into effect. The program will begin in FY27.
Okay. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Just for clarity, I know in the bill it says the effective date takes effect July 1, 2025. So where in the bill does it say that we wouldn't actually be implementing it? Where did in the bill does it say that we'd actually be implemented in 27? Where does it say in the, let me back up.
So
52, line 17 says that the bill would become effective, or the act becomes effective July 1, 2025. And so I don't know where the provision is that's saying that that this law wouldn't become, that this law would be delayed to implement to 27. I'm just wondering where that is.
Representative Kopp.
Through the chair, Representative Bynum. The effective date of the bill gives the administration permission to stand up the program, and it also would be the first time July 1 of 2025 when an employee, existing employee, could make their election into the plan with over a 180-day period. We would need revenue here to comment on why they're projecting costs out the way they are, but it is not uncommon for an initial year to be much lower than out years, and it does. My guess is it takes a while to stand up the plan. Now, if you're looking at personnel costs, or if you're looking at actual fiscal cost of the bill, like the actuarial note, I'm looking at control code VAI November Bravo. If that's the one you're looking at, the actuary has said the reason why is the bill has it starts off fully funded. And the state won't be incurring costs attributable to House Bill 78 until fiscal year 2027. That's what Mr. Kirshner said. And in the report he provided to the committee, he showed an analysis FY 2027 through FY 39. That's exactly how he costed out the bill. So that probably is why we have zeros for FY 26, is that is not anticipated to bring a cost in that year, this legislation.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Just for a follow-up, I'm just trying to find out where in the bill it actually says that cost is going to be delayed, because if an employee starting July 1 is able to opt into this program, even if a new hired employee is able to opt in, and there's cost associated with that, and cost of the plan associated with that, I'd expect to see a fiscal note that would reflect that. Now, what I hear you saying is that we don't know what those costs would be. They're going to take 26 to stand the plan up. That means that participants wouldn't actually be able to be in the plan and participate in the plan until July of 26, not July of 25. And so I'm just trying to find out where in the bill does it actually say that there is a delayed implementation of the actual program.
Representative Kopp.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Byman, there is no delay in the implementation. So don't confuse that. DRB here could explain probably more eloquently why the FY26 component is zero. But remember, employees have 6 months to do anything. They could stay in D.C. You don't know where the employees are going to go. So you're already going to be halfway through FY26 before the election period even tolls, and employees then are, okay, now it's the decision point. But Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Anderson.
For the record, once again, Brody Anderson. I want to apologize to the committee if I misled or misdirected the committee into using the word delayed, and I was not correct in that terminology. I would apologize. Obviously it sounds like by me using delayed definitely has thrown the committee off, and I apologize for that. If that is the core issue of where this delay, which is not a delay, happened, and I apologize to the committee for that.
As we move on to the next bill, I wonder if it's possible if somebody from Division of Retirement and Benefits could maybe call in to just, I don't know if they can shed any more light on that, but. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. We're going to be taking this up again, so we obviously can talk a little bit more about fiscal notes as we move through the process. Just for clarity, which fiscal notes are no longer valid? Just control codes would be fine, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Anderson?
For the record, Chuck Kopp, representative for House District 10. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So to begin with the fiscal note that is valid, control code on the bottom right-hand corner is Victor Alpha India November Bravo. And I would direct members' attention to the third paragraph of the fiscal note. Again, this is provided by the administration. And this explains the answer to Representative Bynum's question. Since this bill would take effect on July 1, 2025, there is no fiscal impact to the PERS and TERS FY 2026 additional state contributions because these amounts have already been adopted by the ARM board. And they go on. But to get further explanation, we could have DRB comment on that further.
Okay, so it says it right in the fiscal note from the administration. Okay.
So the two, through the
Mr.
Chair.
Mr. Anderson?
Sorry, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Brody Anderson, the two fiscal notes that would be considered killed at this point are control code number VAVZK, created by the House Finance Committee, and control code number GPLLD, also written by House Finance Committee. Those two fiscal notes are now considered killed, and they also are no longer reflected on the Ledge Finance fiscal note system.
Thank you.
Okay. Next up in the line, I've got Representative Hannon, then Josephson.
Thank you, Co-Chair. I was just after the kill numbers because, yeah, so
okay.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
I don't have a question anymore because the our majority leader cited the section that reflects that the ARM board has already set the rate for FY26. Thank you.
Okay. Do we have any further questions for the sponsor or for Representative Tomaszewski?
Yes, thank you. Section 23 of the bill, page 14, in regards to the to the payments made to the ARM board being able to, at any time the board may terminate a reduction made under this subsection. Is that individually or is that for the group? Is that for all of the?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski. Good question. So this applies to the entire plan, all members in the plan. If the plan becomes less than 90% funded, then the ARM board is able to make an adjustment. Yes.
Representative Tomaszewski.
And then also just above that in the same subsection for the eligibility requirements for a permanent fund dividend. So it is equal to one half of the applicable percentage under this section. So this basically says if you live out of state, you may only get half of your COLA. Is that right?
Yes, through the chair. Correct.
I'm going to follow up. Is that done anywhere? Do any other states do that? And have you run this by legal? I mean, obviously they drew it up, but have we run this by as far as is that constitutionally, are we able to do that to penalize a person for living in a different state even though they're in the same plan?
Representative Kopp?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, I certainly appreciate the spirit of the question. So, yes, it is constitutional. Any retirement plan, as long as members know what the deal is when they sign up for it, you can structure it. But once they're in it, then you can't diminish the benefits. But as long as they understand how the plan is structured and that, in this case, inflation proofing of their dollar could be diminished by 50% if they choose to move out of state and fall out of residency compliance, as we define it by the permanent fund dividend eligibility standard. If they understand that's part of the deal, that if I lose my residency status in Alaska, my They don't lose all their inflation proofing, but they will lose 50% of it. And this was part of what was rolled out in the CS. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Hennen.
I was just going to thank you, Co-Chair Foster, shine a little light that current plan retirees lose their COLA if they are gone for more than 90 days. So permanent fund dividend eligibility is actually looser than that. But right now, you lose your COLA if you're gone more than 90 days.
Great. Thank you. Do we have any further questions for this Representative Kopp before we move on to the next bill? Okay. Representative Bynum.
Just for clarity for the record, because I know we thought we'd discuss this, that there's a discussion between the terms COLA and there is a different term that we're actually using here in the bill. The PRPA. And so I just didn't want to get confused between the terms COLA in previous PERS 1, 2, or 3 versus what BHB 78 is talking about, and that's the post-retirement pension adjustments.
Representative Kopp.
Yes. Thank you for the question, Representative Bynum. So COLA is not...
For correction, Mr. Chair, it's the term COLA was being used in that line of questioning, mm-hmm. and I was just pointing out for the record that we are not talking about COLA. We are talking about PRPA.
That is correct. Okay. Post-retirement pension adjustments are inflation-proofing of dollars only. COLA is an entirely separate matter that reflects the cost of living in Alaska. Thank you.
Okay. I don't, Representative Hennen.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I wasn't trying to confuse nor inflate the two, but to give an example of is it constitutional to set something, this benefit, at a level where people would be treated differently based on residency? And yes, we already do it in the existing defined benefit system. They're very clear and... Every retiree like myself knows it and keeps account.
Great. Thank you. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Representative Kopp and Mr. Anderson. I think we're going to move on to the next bill. So I don't think there's anything else. Am I missing anything?
Mr. Anderson? Representative Kopp had some final words before.
Absolutely. Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Chair Foster. I just wanted to, you know, direct the committee's memory back to yesterday when the state's actuary said that this retirement plan is structured so soundly that anything short of a remarkable event, he could not foresee it becoming unfunded, certainly not dropping below the 90 percentile level, and he did not foresee the levers even being activated. He did not see the state accruing additional unfunded liability as a result of this. He said that explicitly about three or four times. And I think that's remarkable. It shows how conservative this is. Several members have pointed out it's not overly employee friendly. It's not structured that way to keep the costs down. The heart of this bill recognizes that public workforce stability is key to the economic growth of our state. That's what it's driving at. The cost of the bill was highlighted by the actuary. The present value cost total is about $600 million extrapolated over the next 14 years. If you wrote a check today on that, that's about $50 million a year, $49-50 million a year. And we know that the burn rate of the cash we're going through on our recruitment, retention losses, our hiring losses, and our training and rehire load is over $76 million a year. You could easily say this is a net revenue positive for the state to go in this direction. The actuaries, whether it was the House Finance Committee or the state's actuary or other independent, have all said this bill will do exactly what you say it will do. It will keep and retain employees and cause them to hang in there with you as a state and employer through the long run. So if that is, in fact, our goal, then, I would say we are on the right track to addressing what I see as a real structural problem. Being a longtime fisherman, I would just use a marine analogy, Mr. Chairman. Imagine Alaska as our ship of state. When a vessel has a hole below the waterline, it should slow down immediately. I'm a longtime fisherman. I've experience this, and in many cases you stop rather than maintain speed. Water ingress into the hole increases the faster you're going, produces a structural stress on the hull of the boat, and you come into safety of crew issues and control and buoyancy issues. The analogy is that the water ingress is our nation-leading vacancy rates in our transportation, public safety, and education infrastructures, compromising the vitality of our state. The structural risk is that our public service agencies are overtaxed, they're underperforming, and in many cases completely failing to deliver the services that people depend on. We just have to look at the headlines. We know we're experiencing out-migration, and it's resulting in a toxic narrative about Alaska and about whether businesses and families should invest here. Our control and buoyancy attempts are pay increases, letters of agreement, recruitment and retention bonuses. We know that from singular studies of single employee plans, the governor's recruitment and retention task force found that we're going through about a $20 million a year burn rate in just loss of teachers. That's just one small employee group. So this plan, in light of those things, make it eminently affordable and attractive to the state to make a hard turn towards repairing the hole in our ship of state and bringing us back to a place where I think we can effectively, responsibly make Alaska attractive and competitive as an employer again and be able to do the things we want to. I appreciate the opportunity to give those remarks, Mr. Chairman.
Great. Thank you very much, Representative Kopp. Okay, so with that, we'll jump right over to the next bill. And so with that, we've got HB 91, that's the marijuana tax bill, and I'd like to invite up to the table Representative Carrick as well as her staff, Mr. Stuart Relay. And if you could put yourselves on the record, we do have a presentation from them. We also have available four questions. Bailey Stewart, Chair of the Marijuana Control Board. We've got folks from Department of Public Safety, Division of Behavioral Health, Department of Revenue, and Department of Corrections. If we could hold questions until after the sponsor's introduction, and then we will have one invited testifier, and then we've got some fiscal notes. So we'll get through those, and then we'll take up questions. So, with that, welcome, Representative Carrick, and if you'd like to put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the House Finance Committee. Good afternoon. For the record, Ashley Carrick representing House District 35, West Fairbanks, and very happy to be before you this afternoon. House Bill 91 before you today is probably familiar.
We might have a technical issue possibly. Sure. I'm going to take a brief at ease. Okay, House Finance back on record at 4:54 p.m. Representative Carrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Once again, for the record, Ashley Carrick representing House District 35, West Fairbanks, and thank you to the committee for taking up House Bill 91 today. House Bill 91 may look familiar to the committee members here today. This is a reiteration of the legislation passed by a 36-3 margin in the House during the 33rd legislature just last year. And excepting the member from Palmer on this committee, all members of this committee had previously voted in favor of this policy. So House Bill 91, as a reintroduction, stems from our challenges today in the growing marijuana industry, dare I say, budding marijuana industry. In 2014, Alaska voters legalized recreational marijuana, but after initial growth, the industry has seen stagnation, which has opened the door to black market activity and so-called gray market activity. In 2022, Governor Dunleavy convened the Advisory Task Force on Recreational Marijuana, and its number one recommendation was tax reform, in addition to various policy reforms. House Bill 91 includes both this tax reform and policy changes to support the industry, making it more sustainable and allowing it to flourish for years to come and close the door on the black market. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, in FY24, the marijuana industry had brought in $27.2 million in revenue, greater than any other agricultural product in Alaska today. This revenue went straight towards $13.5 million for the Recidivism Reduction Fund, $6.7 million for the Marijuana Education and Treatment Fund, and $6.9 million in UGF revenue. These funds represent the 100% sole source of funding for both the Recidivism Reduction Fund and the Marijuana Education and Treatment Fund. In addition, this industry produced $48.3 million in wages in 2022, and in February of 2025, there were 475 active licenses. There are also, as of February 2025, 5,828 marijuana handler permits, which are required for anyone involved in commerce in this industry. So, Mr. Chairman, House Bill 91 before you, which will shortly be presented, makes those changes which I believe must be taken in order to stabilize and continue the growth of this industry in Alaska. The House State Affairs Committee also changed the designation of the funds for revenue so that 50% will still go towards the Recidivism Reduction Fund, 25% towards the Marijuana Education and Treatment Fund, but through an amendment from the member from Homer, 25%, which had previously gone to UGF revenue, would now go towards the Public Education Fund as designated funds, and that was supported by the committee.
Representative Carrick, I'm sorry, if we could just take a brief at ease.
Cool. And House Finance back on record at 5:09 p.m., and we are currently receiving a presentation on HB 91, Marijuana Tax Reform. Representative Carrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, House Finance Committee members. Once again, for the record, Ashley Carrick, representative for House District 35 in West Fairbanks. Just to wrap up my initial opening comments, Alaska must make action as expeditiously as possible to stabilize the marijuana industry, but also to stabilize the revenue that these marijuana treatment and education funds and recidivism reduction funds receive in Alaska. House Bill 91 strikes that balance as appropriately as possible, and I look forward to the committee's discussion on this issue. I'd like to turn it over to my staff to walk through a brief presentation on House Bill 91.
Mr. Stuart Relay, if you can put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Stuart Relay, staff for Representative Carrick, and I just want to thank the committee for hearing House Bill 91. So the slides for starting off with the slide deck here, we're just going to kind of briefly cover some recent history on marijuana policy. As many of you know, 2014, it was legalized by ballot initiative. As Representative Carrick said in her opening statement, in 2022, the governor created a task force on recreational marijuana, during the 33rd legislature, again, as Representative Carrick mentioned, House Bill 119, which is a nearly identical bill to this bill, passed the House by a wide margin, and House Bill 91 just picks up the conversation where that left off last session, has an identical tax structure. I would note for committee members, the difference is that there was a 7% sales tax that was adopted on the floor. This version of the bill has a 6% sales tax, which this committee and the Labor and Commerce Committee included in their versions of the previous bill. Just broadly speaking, the task force recommendations that are included in House Bill 91 include Recommendation 1, which is provides immediate tax relief with an excise tax cut from $50 to $12.50 an ounce, and it repeals the excise tax after a transition period and implements a sales tax. That is a 6% sales tax. Recommendation 10, sections 1 and 10 of House Bill 91 specifically allow for upstream sales. This allows for retailers to sell unsold or unused products back to producers, so they can be disposed of safely and made into other products. It also includes Recommendation 11, which is Sections 3 through 9 of the bill relating to biannual licensing, allowing for marijuana facilities, retailers to have two-year licenses. Again, for the committee members' information, just broadly speaking, the marijuana how marijuana revenue is used in Alaska. Last year, it was $27.2 million in total. 50% of that was used for the Recidivism Reduction Fund, which is $13.5 million. 25% of that was used for the Marijuana Education and Treatment Fund, which was $6.7 million. And a change that we made in the State Affairs Committee designates the remaining 25%, or $6.9 million, to the Public Education Fund. Again, the tax structure and reform in HB 91 is in line with the first recommendation of the task force. It provides immediate tax relief by lowering the excise tax from $50 to $12.50 an ounce. That's found in Section 11 of the bill and is effective July 1st of 2025. Section 18 repeals the excise tax effective January 1, 2026. And then there is a 6% sales tax that is established on all consumers. That is found in Section 13 and takes place at the same time that the excise tax cut is repealed. Some policy changes included in the bill. Again, it allows for upstream sales, which allows marijuana stores to sell unused products back to the producers so they can be disposed of and reused safely. This is found in Sections 1 and 10 of the bill. This is the 10th recommendation of the task force. Slide 6 requires a tracking number on each marijuana crop. Currently, growers are required to have tracking numbers or tags for each individual plant. This changes it to per crop. That's just a big barrier for the growers. Again, it changes it to from 1 year to 2 year licensing. It changes required tax payments from monthly to quarterly. This is especially burdensome as producers have to physically deliver cash mostly to Anchorage, and so this would change that from 12 times a year to 4 times a year. And then it also requires the Department of Revenue to establish at least one tax collection facility in each of the 4 judicial districts. One of DOR's fiscal notes had that had them create one here in Juneau, in Fairbanks, and then in Nome. They already have one in Anchorage. Slide 7 here just details some of the differences between HB 91 and SB 73, which is the companion to Representative Tomaszewski's House Bill 94. Those bills have an excise tax cut, and they include the biannual licensing. There's a discussion about the revenue cut that would come with that. That, Mr. Chairman, is the slide deck.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Riley. Again, if we can hold off questions until we get through the invited testimony and the fiscal notes. We are past 5 o'clock. We're at 5:16. I would like to get through at least those and take a few questions, and then we can bring up the we'll set aside the bill. So with that, Ms. Bailey-Stewart, if you're online for invited testimony, if you could introduce yourself, state your name and your title, your affiliation, and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Foster, Chair Josephson, Chair Chiragi, and esteemed members of the House Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Bailey-Stewart, and I serve as the Chair of the Marijuana Control Board. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. The Marijuana Control Board has had the opportunity to review House Bill 91. We appreciate the sponsor's efforts to address important issues, and we understand the need for thoughtful consideration of taxation in our industry. However, due to concerns about the bill's controversial issue to introduce the first statewide sales tax at a 6% rate and the broader implications that may arise from such a measure, the board was not able to fully support it at this time. Additionally, I want to flag a concern that isn't addressed in this bill, the issue of double taxation. Products on the market have already been subject to an existing excise tax, and without a mechanism in place, these products would also be taxed again under a new statewide sales tax. This could create an unintended financial burden unless it's carefully accounted for in legislation. The board recognizes that that moving to a value-based tax structure will ultimately be necessary, especially as we prepare for interstate commerce. However, the board believes that the details of this shift, including appropriate limitations and safeguards, require further attention to ensure a thoughtful and balanced approach. The board is committed to continuing this conversation once the industry has relief, there is less immediate pressure to implement a sales tax, allowing for a more thorough and considered discussion. What I can share with certainty is that the board is strongly supportive of immediate tax relief. Marijuana legalization has been an economic bright spot in Alaska's agriculture sector and has the potential to remain so for years to come if we address the market instability. The board acknowledges that the industry is motivated to continue this conversation and work collaboratively to find a long-term solution. This is especially important as the future possibility of interstate commerce presents a significant challenge under the current excise tax. tax model. Alaska-grown products will face a highly punitive tax burden, while products entering the state from elsewhere may avoid taxation entirely. To preserve the competitiveness of an Alaskan industry and ensure the state continues to collect revenue, it will be necessary to consider transitioning to a sales tax or a distributor-based model. Right now, Alaska's legal marijuana industry is fighting on three fronts, as was mentioned by Representative Carrick. The most urgent issue is a punitive tax structure, which is actively harming businesses and stifling growth. A flat tax of $50 per ounce adds up to $800 per pound on products that may only sell for $2,000 or less. The result is an effective tax rate approaching 50%, an unsustainable burden for any small business. At the same time, the regulated market is forced to compete with two illicit markets, one that operates entirely outside of law and another in a legal gray area involving intoxicating hemp products. The board supports fair competition, but is increasingly challenging for the legal market to remain viable when compliant businesses are held to strict regulations and high taxation, while unregulated operators continue with minimal oversight or prosecution and season of taxation. These pieces of the market share that the legal industry is missing. I want to speak to a concern that has come up in previous hearings, how the legal market can compete with the illicit market. The truth is we will never be able to match the illicit market prices right now, but we have beaten legacy pricing. For decades, an eighth of marijuana, 3.5 grams, cost $40 on the illicit market. The price stayed stagnant for decades until the legal industry came along and introduced real competition. The board's top priority has always been making the legal market the preferred choice. We do that by ensuring safety, transparency, compliance. Licensed businesses take on real costs, taxes, fair wages, workers' compensation, paid leave, business licenses, property taxes. These aren't just costs, they're investments in public health, safety, and trust. That's why any conversation about market competition needs to consider the value that the legal market brings, not just the price tag. While legal marijuana businesses continue to close, the illicit market is thriving. In 2024, the Department of Public Safety seized 316 pounds of illegal marijuana, a significant increase from the 186 seized in 2023. These figures are particularly alarming because the department does not actively investigate or prosecute marijuana-related offenses. These seizures occurred incidentally, not through targeted enforcement. We have not seen illicit market activity at this level since before legalization, underscoring the urgent need for enforcement and tax reforms to support the legal industry and curb the illicit markets and bring those consumers back to the legal market. Next, I want to acknowledge the significant deficit facing the state of Alaska. I understand the concern that some of you have expressed about the potential impact of lowering the excise tax, specifically that its impact will reduce state revenue by approximately $9.6 million. The board shares that same concern. However, I believe there's room to revisit the marijuana tax revenue, how it is designated. Ballot Measure 2 did not mandate the 50% of the excise tax be designated to the Recidivism Reduction Fund. That provision came from SB 91, which was later repealed and replaced by House Bill 49. However, House Bill 49 did not include language continuing that 50% designation. If the legislator had intent to preserve it, I would expect to have seen that reflected in that bill. Meanwhile, recent data, including the 2024 annual report to legislature and the governor from the Alaska Criminal Justice Data Analyst Commission, showed that recidivism has continued to rise since the designation of the excise tax, with the only dip occurring during the pandemic, and that dip is reflected in bookings as well. In addition, the industry overpaid by $1.8 million in our prior fiscal year. Our renewal fees fund the AMCO office, but when those fees exceed the office's budget, the excess is returned to the undesignated general fund. All of this suggests that there may be opportunities to adjust current designated funding in a way that offsets the short-term impact of a tax reduction while still supporting critical state functions. I offer this as a reflection and hope that we can approach these decisions with both physically responsible and long-term sustainability in mind. I'm not one to ask for change without offering solutions. The board recognizes that not everyone supports marijuana, but this issue extends beyond personal opinions about it. It is fundamentally about public health and safety and ensuring tax revenue is collected and reinvested into Alaska's economy and supporting job creation throughout an Alaskan-owned and operated industry, one of the few that is truly homegrown. The regulated market is the only framework that guarantees marijuana is sold responsibly with strict age verification and product safety standards. In contrast, illicit and unregulated markets do not offer these protections. Ensuring a strong legal industry is the best way to keep marijuana at the hands of minors and maintain a well-regulated system that prioritizes public safety and economic stability. Lastly, I would like to address Section 2 of HB 91, which proposes placing batch tagging requirements into statute. Over the past year, the Marijuana Control Board has carefully revised plant tagging regulations to balance public health, safety, and enforcement needs. The board already has statutory authority to implement batch tagging through regulation and has intentionally approached these changes gradually to ensure that they are effective and practical. At its most recent meeting, the board opened a new regulations project to begin the fact-finding process and draft language for a potential batch tagging implementation. Last year, the board transitioned cloned tagging to batch tagging and raised the tagging threshold from 8 inches to 18 inches. However, we recently learned that moving to full batch tagging under the current tracking system would significantly increase costs, charging cultivators per plant versus per tag, and more than doubling the state's annual subscription hosting fees. I understand a revised fiscal note reflected these increased costs will be incorporated into the bill. In closing, the industry needs stability, and tax reduction is one of three key components in achieving that. While my understanding is the industry and the control board currently does not have consensus on transitioning to a sales tax, I can tell you that the board is motivated to return year after year to address excise tax reform. The reason is simple. If and when interstate commerce is allowed, the current excise tax will only apply to Alaskan businesses at a significant disadvantage. The industry is highly motivated to continue this conversation. I urge you to take action that strengthens the legal industry to support meaningful reduction in the marijuana excise tax and reconsider how these funds are designated and remove batch tagging from the language of this bill, leaving it to a regulatory process. I'm happy to answer any questions the committee may have, and thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Stewart. I think we're going to have some questions, but first, I would also like to get to our fiscal notes. We have quite a few people online, and I would like to maybe see, do you have your comments that you can submit? Are those written comments? I think there might be more questions. We might not be able to get to all the questions today, but if we had your written testimony, then folks could kind of refer back to some of the areas where they might have had some questions. Do you have that in writing that you could submit to us?
Through the chair, yes, I do.
Okay, that'd be great.
And I can submit that to the committee.
Yes, if you could do that. I'm going to go to the fiscal notes here, and then we'll jump into questions and get as far along as we can tonight. It's getting a little bit late, and I think folks might have places to go, so I want to make sure we're at least getting this on the record. So with that, we're going to jump over to Mr. Director Kevin Richard with the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office. If you could walk us through your fiscal notes.
Through the chair, yes. This is Kevin Richard, Director of the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office. We submitted a fiscal note regarding HB 91. Most recently, I believe it was yesterday or this morning, this fiscal note incorporates about accounts for the offsets in revenue from switching to a biennial licensing process, and then the additional cost that would be imposed by having an additional $10,000 for regulatory review on the renewal years, and then there is a regarding Section 2 of the bill, the switching to a batch tagging process would incur an additional $250,000 a year with our marijuana inventory tracking system.
Thank you, Mr. Richard. And just to confirm, so it's on the record, is your OMB component on your fiscal note 3119 and the control code is NXLEL? Is that correct?
Yes, through the chair, yes.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, next I'm going to jump over to Kevin Worley, Administrative Services Director with the Department of Corrections. Mr. Worley, if you could put yourself on the record and maybe just cite the control code in the bottom right of your fiscal note.
Thank you. This is Kevin Worley, Director of Administrative Services, Department of Corrections. For fiscal note control code, I'm looking at ARZTL.
Mr. Worley, you're pretty muffled, and also we may not have the same fiscal note that you have. Can you maybe get a little closer to the microphone?
I'm sorry, could you say that again? We're not coming through here.
Okay, we can hear you a little bit better there. Can you repeat the fiscal note or the control code? The one that we show is LYRIU.
Okay. The one that I was looking at was capital AR and lowercase ZTL, so find a different.
Is your OMB component number 2244?
2244 is the correct component number.
And what's the date? What's the date on yours? We have April
7, 2025. The date that I had was March 12th. I do prefer the updated fiscal note, but I was looking at the one that was online as of this afternoon.
Okay, yeah, we've got a more updated one of April 7. But if you don't have that one before you, did you say you do not have that one, April
7?
I wonder if maybe Mr. Stuart Relay or Representative Carrick, if you could walk us through, I think you've probably got the newer one, if you could walk us through that, and then Mr. Worley can add any comments as needed. And maybe the one you have, Mr. Worley, well, I'll leave that up to the sponsor, Representative Carrick. Would you like to walk us through? I'm seeing general funds, UGF, the fund source here is $2,573,700. But in terms of the actual explanation on the back, Mr. Worley, can you maybe walk us through a little bit of the explanation for what your fiscal note was? The numbers might differ a little bit from what we have, but can you walk through what you have?
Yes, sir. Actually, I do have the control code now, capital L, capital Y, R, I, and capital U.
Perfect.
So the impact to the Department of Corrections for OMB component number 2244 impacts our community residential centers, or which are our halfway houses. And based on the reduction on the spring revenue forecast, so we were seeing a reduction in the recidivism fund, which is fund source 1246. The impact to the Department of Corrections is a reduction of recidivism fund by $2.6 million, or the 2573.7 for FY26. We would need a backfill of that same amount in UGF for the 1004 general fund code. And that would be the impacts going through FY26 through 2031. We would see, again, reductions in 1246, starting at $2.2 million for 27, down to $1.8 million for FY2031.
Great. Thank you very much. Next up, we have Tracy Dumpling with Behavioral Health. Ms. Dumpling, you've got two fiscal notes, if you can walk us through those.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Tracy Dumpling. I'm the Director for the Division of Behavioral Health. And we have two fiscal notes. The first one is under the Behavioral Health Administration component. It's component number 2665. And the control code is DQBZU. And on the first fiscal note, it primarily identifies the designated general fund dollars, both in the recidivism fund and the marijuana education tax fund, that would be a reduction within the DBH budget. And then the accompanying general fund request money that would be needed to offset that reduction. These reductions go to support several grants within DBH. Those are outpatient grants, peer support and consumer grants, substance use disorder, residential and withdrawal management, also supports Bethel Community Sobering Center, some discharge incentive grants, and lastly, sorry, flipping my page, a recidivism reduction grant program. For the second fiscal note, under the Behavioral Health Treatment and Recovery Grant, this is OMB component number 3099, control code YQIDW. This fiscal note is the same, identifies the reductions that we would see in the designated general fund dollars in both the recidivism fund and the marijuana education tax fund, and then the accompanying general fund dollars, which would be needed within the division to offset the cost of those reductions. Those reductions would be to grants, grant components similar to just what I explained in the previous fiscal note.
Great. Thank you very much. We've got three more. It's Michael Hughes with Public Health. Mr. Hughes, if you could walk us through your fiscal note. Let's see here. Michael Hughes, Public Health. There might be somebody else online. Is Heather Rogers there?
Thank you. Yes, this is Heather Rogers, Administrative Operations Manager for Department of Health, Division of Public Health. And I am speaking to OMB component number 2818, control number PLOXW. And very similar to the Division of Behavioral Health, the spring forecast has predicted that we will have a revenue decline, and therefore our marijuana education fund that supports youth services grant program would be reduced. And so we are asking for, this fiscal note is asking that we replace that with general fund.
Great. Thank you very much. Next up, Diana Thornton with Council on Domestic Violence. If you could walk us through your fiscal notes.
Yes, hello. For the record, this is Diana Thornton, Administrative Services Director with the Department of Public Safety. And I'm speaking to fiscal note control number EAK, V as in Victor M. This is for OMB component 521. The allocation is the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. The Department of Public Safety received the spring forecast from the reduction would affect for FY26 would be $597,000.2, FY27 $513,900, $490,200 in FY28 and on down to FY2031 with $408,100. We would request that these funds be replaced with general funds. They support programs for battery intervention and other programs within the CDBSA council.
Great. Thank you very much. And the last fiscal note that we have is Brandon Spanos. If you can put yourself on the record.
Yes, for the record, Deputy Director with the Department of Revenue Tax Division, Brandon Spanos. And my control number on my fiscal note is WSBPX. This is for component number 2476. And I'll start with the revenue impact. The change in year one in fiscal year 2026 is from two parts. First, going from $50 per ounce for butter flour down to $1,250 per ounce for half of the fiscal year, and then moving to a 6% sales tax for the second half of the fiscal year would have a $9.7 million reduction in revenue impact. And then in the future years, you can see there on page one, there's a decrease over the years. And there's several assumptions that are on page two of the fiscal note that I won't go into in detail here, but happy to answer any questions. These numbers are using our spring 2025 forecast and sales data that we received from AMCO for fiscal year 24. So it's the newest available data. As has been stated previously, currently those revenues are mixed between three funds, the recidivism fund at 50%, the marijuana education and treatment fund at 25%, and the UGF, or unrestricted general fund, at 25%. And this bill would change that last one to a K-12 program. And so on page three of our fiscal note, we break out the changes in revenue by each fund. On page one, it only allows us to show two funds at a time, so we've detailed that out on page three, and you can see how that breaks out by each one of those funds. And then moving on to the implementation cost, the change to $12.50 an ounce for the flower actually would be a fairly simple change. That's just changing the tax rate that's already programmed in our system. However, the change to a sales tax is quite a big lift. We'd have to set up a sales tax module. There's a new taxpayer base, so the taxpayers that are currently paying the marijuana tax would no longer pay it, and there would be new taxpayers that would need to pay the tax, and we would need to register them and have a sales tax module built. That is, as I mentioned, a pretty big lift. It would normally take us around 12 months to build something like that, so to do it on an expedited timeline. By January 1, we would anticipate that being at a $2 million cost. Otherwise, it's still a $1 million cost if we had a longer period of time. And then the second part of the costs to administer would be having a cash depository in each of the four judicial districts. As has been mentioned, we already have one in Anchorage, so there would be no additional cost for that one. But there would be, for the other three districts, we would anticipate having in District 1 a location in Juneau where we already have an office, but we don't have staff dedicated to counting the cash, and that does take quite a bit of staff time. And then for District 2, we would have a cash drop location. We would anticipate having a drop location in Nome, but no staff on site. Staff would either travel from Anchorage, Juneau, or Fairbanks to go up and collect and then process the cash back into our locations. And then in Fairbanks, we would have a depository with staff on site to process that cash. There's also costs for the locations, the safe, the drop safe, security, and transportation of the cash.
Great, thank you.
And the costs are detailed on page three.
Great, thank you very much, Mr. Spanos. I do have a lineup here, so folks have questions for either Ms. Bailey Stewart or any of the folks who have presented fiscal notes. We'll open that up. In line, I do have Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Josephson, Representative Hannon. I do have a very quick question. Representative Carrick, do we have a total on all these seven fiscal notes, what the required backfill for UGF would be?
Mr. Chair, we don't. I can get that to the committee as soon as possible. A couple of these fiscal notes came in today, so okay. I just haven't had a chance to do a tally on all the UGF backfill that was projected as of this morning.
Perfect. Yeah, the next meeting would be fine. So with that, we'll go to Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. My question was not for the fiscal notes, so you may want to...
Ms. Bailey is fine also. Or the sponsor.
Oh, yeah, or for the sponsor. Okay, so thank you through the chair. You talked about requiring the number for each crop to be... How many are in it? How many plants in a crop? It was individual dollar per plant. Now it's per crop. What is that amount?
Mr. Stewart Bailey,
Relay, Stuart. Yes. Stuart Relay. Yes. There we go. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, I don't have the number off the top of my head. I do know that that is a standard term in the industry, a standard industry term. We're happy to get that information for you, though.
Okay. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair.
Ms. Kirk. Representative Kirk.
I just also would note through the chair to Representative Tomaszewski that this issue, since we first introduced the bill this year, has been substantively, I think, addressed through regulation. So I would also strongly encourage the committee to take out Section 2 of the legislation. This was not an issue that had been addressed previously, but has since been addressed. And I do not think the language in Section 2 is relevant anymore to the concern that had been previously brought forward.
Great. Okay. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Ms. Stewart, are you still with us?
Representative Joseph, through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes, I am.
The first thing, Ms. Stewart, I really look forward to your written testimony. I really only could hear about two-thirds or better of what you said because it just wasn't fully audible for me. But the sponsor talked about there being 475 licenses, and I recall during my campaign I knew the number at one point of how many dispensary licenses there were just in my hometown of Anchorage. You don't happen to know that, do you?
I do not. Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I do not have regional numbers.
Follow-up.
However,
Ms. Stewart?
Through the chair, I understand that Director Richards is on the line, and I believe that he would be best able to answer that question.
Okay. I guess where I'm going with this, Ms. Stewart, is I think the number was something like 75 or better. And I'm just wondering, has the board considered either if it's possible through regulation or if it's necessary through legislation to have some sort of equivalent to a DBL licensure? I mean, I guess I'm just trying to figure out why, as horrible as this sounds, why it's important that I protect 75 different licensees, for example, in Anchorage. Why is that a good idea?
Ms. Stewart?
Well, through the chair, Representative Josephson, I believe, you want as many retails out there currently as possible to help make to help be competitive with the illicit market. Now, there is controversy within the industry about how many licenses are out there and if that's actually sustainable for Alaska. However, the goal is to incentivize Alaskans to purchase tested regulated product to incentivize the public health and safety aspects of consuming marijuana. So there has been no limitations on issuing licenses as of yet.
Representative Josephson?
So I didn't – somehow I got through college without economics, certainly as a separate class, weirdly. But I'm right, am I not, Ms. Stewart, that if there were half as many dispensaries, those would begin to thrive? Isn't that just got to be sort of true?
Ms. Stewart?
To the chair, Representative Josephson, I believe that you are on the right path. And I do believe a reduction in licenses could potentially help the licenses out there.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Hennen.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I have one set of questions for Ms. Stewart and one with Mr. Spano. So I'm going to start with Ms. Stewart since she was fresh there. Ms. Stewart, early in your testimony, you spoke to not being supportive of the sales tax because of the concern over duplicate tax on products. There's a six-month gap now between the reduction of the excise tax and the implementation of the sales tax. What would be the time frame that you think would be necessary so that you didn't end up with a duplication tax at the sales tax level? So if 6 months doesn't get there and would have duplicate tax, how long would it take before we weren't giving a duplicate tax if we were going to a sales tax implementation?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon. My understanding is that the implementation would happen on January 1st, 2026 for the sales tax, and the excise tax would end simultaneously. However, I believe that there is data within the state's tracking system that would help narrow in what that would look like, how much of a turnover the product is. I'm not completely sure what that timeline would look like, but I do believe research needs to be done there to ensure that we're not adding a double tax to the product that's on the market that will effectively work against the industry and for public health and safety, incentivizing people to purchase within the retails.
Follow up. So your concern is that the excise and sales tax are overlapping. I guess I read it as there was a six-month implementation where it wasn't, but would 6 months you think would be an adequate time period?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I believe that would be a much better timeline in order to remove the products that have seen the sales tax prior to the implementation of the retail sales tax. However, I do not have a degree in economics, nor have I seen the data within the state's tracking system, but I believe you're on the right path with that kind of a gap.
Okay, thank you. And then if I could go to Mr. Spanos.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Mr. Spanos, I've read the revenue fiscal note, and as you know, it's fairly dense with material. I'm not seeing the generation of revenue from a sales tax. So can you tell me in the bill? The bill implements a sales tax. Can you show me or tell me in your fiscal note where that's accounted for? Or is revenue concluding that we don't make any money off of a sales tax?
Through the chair, again, for the record, Brandon Spanoff, Deputy Director of the Tax Division, Representative Hannon. The fiscal note is based off of our spring forecast revenue numbers. And so the spring forecast is forecasting revenue from our current tax structure, so the $50 per ounce wholesale tax. And so the fiscal note is anticipating a decrease due to the sales tax. So the sales tax would come in FY 2031 at $6.6 million less than the forecasted current structure.
Follow up.
So thank you, Co-Chair Foster. So Mr. Spanos, I understand that the fiscal note is based on the revenue forecast, but is not reflecting what the bill is asking to do. So can you produce a fiscal note that would tell us what we would anticipate a sales tax producing in revenue? I understand there'll be a loss in the excise tax, but there should be revenue generated by a sales tax. So, and you wouldn't have had that in your spring revenue forecast because we don't have a sales tax on marijuana. Is that something we need to explicitly ask for? And if so, then I am asking.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, we can provide that detail. The fiscal note is the net effect of the two taxes, but we can provide the detail on what the projected revenue from a sales tax would be. Sure.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. And I understand it's the net effect, but you know the phrasing we sometimes use is we've got different levers, and if I only see the result of what the final is without knowing which lever is being pulled, it's harder for me to make a policy decision. So I need to not only know where I'm losing money, I need to be able to anticipate where there would be gains and go it's 6% or 10%. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kirk?
Just briefly, Mr. Chair, through the chair, Representative Hannon, I just wanted to respond that a previous iteration of the legislation had an implementation date delayed for 18 months, and so hearing committee discussion would be supportive of pushing out that effective date from 6 months to 18 months to better account for that structural change. And I just wanted to make that note to the first question.
Well, I thank everyone for being here, and thank you to our invited testifier and the fiscal note presenters. We're going to go ahead and set the bill aside for now.
I realize today is only Wednesday, but I did want to give a little bit of a heads up for next week. We'll be picking up the pace. We've been doing a couple two-a-days, but starting next week, we're going to be doing every day two-a-days, morning and afternoon meetings. So just so folks know, I think next week we're going to be going heavy on the capital budget along with the bills. So our next scheduled meeting is tomorrow, May 1st at 9 a.m., and at that meeting we'll hear a presentation on the state debt summary and credit review by the Department of Revenue. And if there's nothing else to come before the committee, we'll be adjourned at 5:53 p.m. Thanks.